Well, this is a conference about Australia's place in the world, essentially, and especially in East Asia. The point is that we can't isolate ourselves here from the rest of the world and the rest of Asia. And we have India and China on our doorstep, virtually. India over to the west and China to the north. These are the great industrial powers of the future. And we have to think about what's happening in them, even in as local a sphere, in a sense, as urban transport. Because what happens there affects us, and what we do affects them. Now, I've noticed recently China is watching Australia very carefully, watching Australia for what it does in minerals, of course, but also in climate change policy. And we had a Professor Pan recently, I saw reported in The Age, fairly critical of Prime Minister Rudd's backflip on climate change. We can't isolate ourselves here in Australia for what is going to go on in the rest of the world, especially not in areas like the gradual depletion of oil and climate change policy and the onset of climate change. That's a global issue. And let's sort of think of a question here. Do we in fact think, do we believe that Australians are worth 10 times more than Chinese people or 20 times worth more than Indian people? Because that is the assumption on which our policy seems to be based. Now, we have 20 times more mobility than Indians, probably, and if we look at how far people travel and their access to mobility, perhaps 10 times more than Chinese people. We emit 4 times more than the global average per capita in carbon emissions. We pollute the planet 4 times more per person. So do we believe that each person on the Earth is created equal, or are we somehow better? If we do believe that people are equal, then each person has the same right to mobility and the same responsibility to reduce carbon emissions. Well, it has a role to play. Whether it's a leader or not is questionable. I'm not sure that Australia is in a position to lead China and India, but at the same time, it's not in a position to lag China and India. Australia must do its bit and must be seen to do its bit. Climate change is an immensely serious problem for the future, as Garnaut pointed out, and we all seem to have forgotten, and Stern in England. And we can't escape the consequences. And those consequences are huge for places like China and India, which have enormous populations depending on water from the glaciers, from the Himalayas and Tibet. And that water is necessary for food production for these places. We have places like Bangladesh, which are in severe danger of flooding. Now, all those threats impinging on these places in Asia are eventually going to come home to us. We can't isolate ourselves and say, oh, it's nothing to do with us, because they will be watching us. And what we do actually is going to count, and we have to behave ethically, just as we expect Asian countries to behave ethically. We're having to look a long distance into the future, but we have to act very quickly, because the more we look into the future and the long distance, the more we realise that we actually have to act very rapidly on climate change. And that means we have to reduce our emissions from transport quickly, which is quite alarming, actually. We have to reduce our emissions in transport by a factor of some 18 times in order to bring ourselves into parity with the rest of the world, with not only with the global average, but reducing the global average if we're going to reach the sort of reduced levels of greenhouse emissions compatible with climate safety, some 400 parts per million, and in James Hansen, the NASA scientist, reckons it's 350, and we've already surpassed 350 by a considerable distance. There's been a bit of a tendency to think that sustainability is about three things: economic prosperity, environmental security, and social justice and social equity or whatever. So there's the social, economic and environmental aspects of sustainability. My argument would be that these three elements pull away from one another. They're not mutually supporting, because climate equity means that we have to do something very drastic about economic growth. Environmental security, likewise, means that we have to do something very drastic about the nature of economic growth. And in a sense, climate equity, equity in terms of mobility, spreading mobility fairly in the world, also militates against environmental security. So what we have to go for is institutions which manage to somehow make those divergent goals compatible. And that's not an easy task, as we found at Copenhagen and subsequently, and all the things that are happening around the world now, which seem to be pulling apart, are revealing the way these goals are divergent. We've got to work actually a lot harder to get things to move in a sustainable direction. What we're trying to do in this conference is bring out these diverse contexts. India and China want mobility. One of our keynote speakers is going to say that Asia is wheels crazy. It's mobility crazy. They want movement. And of course they have a right to it, just as we do. We are a very mobile society, technologically, and Asia and India and China and the Asian countries are wanting to catch up fast, and they are catching up fast. But that has huge consequences for not only global issues like climate change, but also the future of their own cities. Because if you think about what most Asian cities are like, they're much, much more dense than, say, a city like Melbourne. And they can't really go down the American road of enormous individual mobility without actually wrecking their cities. So we're not a very good model. But the purpose of the conference is to explore these issues in a sort of East Asian context and not from a purely Australian context. And on the last day of the conference, we're going to have a public forum which comes back to Melbourne and tries to set Melbourne in that sort of context and says, well, what are the lessons here with all these speakers? What are they telling us? What lessons do we have for Melbourne? So we're beginning at a very global level and an East Asian level, and Melbourne and Australia are a part of that context. But we're going to be coming back to Melbourne on the last day and saying, well, what does it all mean for us? We are an extraordinarily lucky society. We have immense mobility. We have extraordinary prosperity and wealth. We have very livable cities. In some ways, we're moving in the right direction from the point of view of investing much more heavily in public transport, as is going to be necessary. So all those things put us on the right path. But the problem here is that if you look at Melbourne in the global context, we're not doing so well. And we're not really setting a very good example for the rest of the world and our East Asian colleagues. You know, when you think of many Chinese people and Indian people who have no car mobility and who aspire to it, who first get on their bikes and then they get on their motorbikes and their putputs, and then they get the car. They're probably always going to be a minority in Asia of car owners. What is it, 1 in 20 own a car, less perhaps in India, 1 in 10 in China, so our car ownership rates are much, much higher than those in most Asian countries and the big industrial economies of India and China. And, you know, if the Indians and the Chinese look at us and say, well, this is what we aspire to, it's really an impossible dream and a very self-defeating dream, because those cities will not support this kind of transport. Well, I think Singapore does provide a very interesting model of high car ownership and high car use, but also a brilliant public transport system, and a public transport system linked to very careful land use planning. So the whole thing works together very well. But the amount of driving in Singapore is extraordinary. It's actually higher than Australia, amazingly enough. The co-ownership rate is less, but those who own cars drive them more, even more than Australia does. So Singapore is a rather strange model, but I think it does provide a model for Asian cities, which Asian cities kind of are used to. It's high density, very integrated forms of transport. I think for Australia, that the Singapore model is unlikely to work very well because we have relatively low density cities, and we'd be better off looking to Europe and the way that European cities run their public transport and how they do it, how it's a much more integrated process than we have here. There's a lot to be said about integrated transport, and I'm sure that that issue will come up in the conference. And I think that one of the issues for Australia is how do we move away from a disaggregated and disjointed transport system where you have, traditionally, you have buses running for bus customers and trains running for train customers and trams running for tram customers and cars, likewise, on the road, to a system where people are basically mobility customers and want a system which serves their mobility needs in the best possible way and in a way which doesn't destroy the city in the process. We have to remember that Australian cities don't really have very strong planning systems. The planners can't really make things occur in the places that they want them to occur. We'd like that to happen, but in practice it doesn't, and we're so much behind Europe in that respect. When Europe devises a plan, it's usually implemented. In Australia, we devise a plan and a couple of years down the track it's changed and it's infinitely flexible. So we are weak in planning. No, that's not the fault of the planners. It's just the fault of the whole political system of planning. So I think we have to address transport as well as land use planning and together with land use planning. But we can't expect land use planning by itself to save us from our transport defects. I think we've got to learn to provide better, more integrated transport for the low density cities that we have and that we are. And it can be done, as is shown in European instances. Well, I'm very hopeful it can be done. I'm a lot less hopeful about the response. We've seen what a very powerful industry can do when it wants to resist action in the public interest. We've seen the enormous campaign launched by the mining industry against this new tax, which seems generally fair, produced by Kevin Rudd. We've seen the enormous lobbying which took place around climate change policy. And when it comes to the crunch, big industries don't really want to change. There are industries which do want to change, but probably right now they're in a minority, I think, and their voice is rather less loud than the ones that don't. And of course, we have some big carbon emitting industries in Australia, including coal and aluminium, which have huge vested interests in continuing just the way we are. And the industries around transport are probably pretty resistant to change. And I come back to that problem I started with, which was the kind of opposing forces in around sustainability. On the one hand, economic growth, and it's not just economic growth, but it's economic growth in the form of business as usual, pulling against environmental security and social justice and economic justice for the world's peoples. So these divergent forces are really strong, and we're going to have to devise very strong institutions to hold them together and in the interests of sustainability and the interests of the global future. We have a range of very interesting very articulate speakers, and I know most of them. Lee Shipper is an engineer from Stanford, probably one of the world's leading authorities on sustainable transport, and leading authorities on Asia, actually, from America, from an American perspective. And he's going to be telling us about sustainable transport. We have Professor Geetam Tiwari from India, from our sister center in Delhi. And she's a terrific speaker, really exciting, and she will tell it from an Indian perspective. We have Professor Doi from Japan, who will be talking about the right to mobility. We have Professor Jiangyu Lin from China, from our sister center in Beijing, talking about the issues from a Chinese perspective. So we're going to get a range of international perspectives. And finally, we have Professor Peter Newman, who everybody knows here, I'm sure, talking about Australia and its international context. Peter is on the board of Infrastructure Australia, and of course he's one of the leading exponents of sustainable transport in this country. So it's going to be a very exciting range of keynote speakers. In addition to that, we will have some 40 papers from academics all over the region, including Australia, of course, giving very specific papers about specific aspects of the problem. And we'll almost certainly have parallel tracks. So you'll have to choose one or the other, or people can go to the papers they are particularly interested in on a variety of themes. And then finally, we'll have the forum, which will be addressing the question of Melbourne and where Melbourne stands in this global scene. We very much welcome members of the public who would like to sign up for the conference. We have to make a charge. We've tried to keep this charge low. It's probably a quarter of what professional conferences charge for something similar. We think we have one of the best conferences on this topic ever run in Australia, certainly the most international. And we do want to appeal to the public to come along, sign up, come to the forum, and you will be welcome. You don't have to be an academic. You can be a professional, a consultant, just a member of the public, member of the community who has concerns about transport.